It's easy to hear your favorite artist on WFPK from wherever you are. Listen on your smart speaker, live stream from our website at WFPK.org from Louisville Public Media.
Oh, I got in easily. It's always a good day when Zoom starts correctly.
Consequence Podcast Network.
Jorge Army and fellow music fans, I'm Kayla.
And I'm Bethany, and we're the hosts of Standing BTS from the Consequence Podcast Network. We're a bi-weekly show that covers the impact and legacy of K-pop group BTS.
We mix the perfect blend of research and fangirl as we take a deep dive into lyrics during album reviews, theorize over music videos, and keep up with their current events.
No BTS topic is off limits. We welcome everyone into the conversation, whether you're a casual fan, committed ARMY, or someone who's just curious about one of the biggest music groups in the world.
Come chat with us every other Thursday with a new episode wherever podcasts are found.
Welcome to the In Defense of Ska podcast.
There's a lot of like, okay, well, you like ska, name three bands that aren't the Boss Tones.
I'm your host, Aaron Carnes, music journalist and author of the book In Defense of Ska.
And I'm your co-host, Adam Davis, veteran ska musician from the bands Omnigon and Link 8.
On our show, we aim to push back on the mainstream's negative perception of ska music.
There are so many great untold stories throughout the history of ska. The show features interviews with everyone from the Mighty Mighty Boss Tones to Fishbone, Fall Out Boy singer Patrick Stump, and the Police drummer Stuart Copeland. Join us on In Defense of Ska from the Consequence Podcast Network.
Hey, and welcome to another edition of Kyle Meredith with... It's the interview series presented by WFPK, WFPK.org, Consequence, and the Consequence Podcast Network. Thanks, as always, for making your way here. Checking out the series and the episode. I do hope you like what you hear enough to hit the subscribe button. I put out three brand new interviews every single week. It's a new one every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday to keep you up to date on your favorite artists. And discover those new ones at Spotify and Apple Podcast, at NPR, WFPK.org, YouTube for the video versions, or anywhere you get your podcast from, you can subscribe to Kyle Meredith with. Recent guests that I've had on the show have included Corey Taylor of Slipknot, Michael C. Hall, the actor, his band Princess Goes. We had Andy Taylor, formerly of Duran Duran, Rat Boys, Westlife, Tommy Stinson of The Replacements, Jerry Harrison of The Talking Heads. We had Lena Waithe on to talk about Being Mary Tyler Moore, the filmmakers behind Heart of Stone, They Clone Tyrone, and Landscape with Invisible Hand. I've also talked to Idina Menzel, The Hives, Barry Manilow. That's just an example of what you get three times a week when you subscribe to the Kyle Meredith With podcast. That's me, Kyle Meredith, today talking with John Baisley of Baroness. They're back with a new album called Stone, and it's not a color this time, which is what they've done in the past. We're going to talk about his penchant for short album titles in the likes of the like the first four Led Zeppelin records. We'll hear about how his lyrics tell his own personal story with hopes that it relates to everyone's own personal stories, using genre and melody to get his point across. John's also going to go on to compliment Nick Cave, PJ Harvey, and Radiohead's strong sense of self within their band. I'll hear about seeing Sonic Youth and Nirvana as his first and second live shows, and how he says he was entirely lost while making this LP. It's all that and more as we talk about Stone. It's Kyle Meredith with John Baisley of Baroness.
Yeah, nice to meet you as well.
What a powerful record that Stone is.
Thank you.
And great to hear you guys again. Maybe we just start with that song title, because I feel like that probably speaks for something beyond just a title. I mean, obviously, maybe, I should say, not obviously, but this feels like getting away from the colors to more elements, although stone could be a color. But it feels like a word that probably says a lot with a little.
Yeah, yes, I would agree with you there. And I would further that by saying that those are the type of titles that I gravitate towards for a variety of reasons. You know, practically speaking, I don't like longer titles. I think, you know, and I should preface this by saying, like, when I have opinions like this, I'm only applying them to us. I think there are great, well-titled albums in history. Many, many, many of them. So many, in fact, that when I've tried to create compelling, pointed, specific, sharp, focused titles, I fall flat because I feel like I don't have the knack for that. You know, some people are graphic designers. It's efficient communication. For me, it's like the more fine a point I try to put on my, communication at that level, the weirder it gets. And so I've always enjoyed those titles that are either simple and broad enough that each list, and this is what I really prefer, is where each listener can find their own meaning through the title, because clearly the artist has a purpose, you know, and has a reason, whether it's explicit or implicit or something they're going to speak of or not. I find as a listener, we take two things. We take the album title and we take the cover of the record, and we tend to find ourselves in there, because we don't, 9 times out of 10, we don't understand the references, and it's not really important that we do. It's more of a feeling. It's more of a, you know, sort of a conceptual artistic thing. So I think titles are great like that. Like I like, you know, Zeppelin, first four Zeppelin records, 1, 2, 3, 4, easy. And there's something that's got a unique fourness about four, and there's something that's got a unique two-ness about two, and a unique oneness to one. So it's not to say that those titles aren't applicable to the music somehow in some, you know, in some sort of a abstract way. But I like that because I can't, you know, because I can't come up with good long-winded titles, and because I really appreciate those records in my life, those, you know, those creative pieces of music that aren't explained in like a prosaic way to me, to the point where I feel that my own experience is then invalid when listening to a song. You know, not to say that that's always the case, but when you listen to great American songwriters like Springsteen or Cash or something, and they're telling legitimate stories, or even, you know, like a great deal of like 90s hip hop, I thought always had these, it was like these stories about these people who are going through these, you know, like a story that has a beginning, a middle, and an end. And I that's, that type of songwriting doesn't come particularly easy to me. And furthermore, when you hear it, you as a listener transport yourself into that person. So you are empathizing with this fictionalized character from a song. That is a great, I mean, that's fantastic. I had great experiences doing that. That's just not the experience people have with our music. That's not the experience I have writing. And I'm not trying to, you know, from a lyricist chair, I'm not trying to imagine some book, some fictionalized character or somebody else's life. I'm not trying to co-opt the things and that I see other people going through and try to bring them into me. My goal with the titling, with the artwork, with the music, with, you know, with the level of, with the type of art that we make, with the type of creativity we try to access, it's about telling a personal story. But in a sort of, I guess, in the inverse way, when I tell a very uniquely and densely and sometimes heavily personal story, I find that the language that I use tends to become a little bit more poetic and a little broader and a little more cloaked in metaphor and symbolism, in order that I don't give something too specific away, but also because I think the way I approach these creative things, and I know I'm still answering your question about the title, incidentally, but for me, it's telling a deeply personal story in such a way that there's the elements of universal apply to it. So if I'm able to dig in deep and introspectively and you know, relate some aspect of a story or some feeling of an experience, our audience and listeners will find those points of congruity and points of synchronization with their own lives, but then expound on it and make something better. And so to make a very short, easily answerable question, somewhat longer, I think for me, it's because I'm telling a story that's so intimate for me, I think that addressing elements of universal and elements of broad are helpful for our listeners to get into that world. Because at the very end of the day, the story isn't like about that personal story of mine. It's that I think that my personal story is everyone's personal story, because we all feel frustration, we all feel the stress, we all feel heartache, we all feel pain, we all feel frustrated and lonely and isolated, and all of these, you know, I tend towards the negative things that have happened to me, and I've got plenty of them. So it's a deep wellspring, I'll put it that way. But because of that, I don't think that those things make me different. I think those things make me the same. And what am I doing as an artist through our music? If nothing else, I'm trying to communicate with the world that I don't have a better form of communication with. I feel, you know, throughout my life, I felt quite at odds with the things that are happening around me. So I think this music is a vehicle for me. It's a very important one. So even when it comes to like an album title like Stone, see, I'm trying to bring this back full circle. It must have deep layers of meaning for me, but it's not, I'm not so presumptuous to think that my deep layers of meaning have anything to do with you or interesting or anything other than pretentious. So I'll hyperload everything, but then I want to serve that on a platter to an audience and let them have fun with it if they want to have fun with it, but go deeper and, you know, try to pick apart that mystery. If they're curious, you know, it's like, I want to present something fairly to our audience.
That's all my favorite artists. That's what they do. You know, all my favorite artists, it's maybe you get a good top line melody or something, you know, to sing along to. And then suddenly you realize, wait a second, what's that line I've been singing that? What is it? You know, what is it? That's the best thing. You know, when it becomes its own little mystery or its own little novel.
Right. And so we as artists use tools like genre, we use tools like style, we use tools like volume and tone and drums and guitars and voices. They're all tools that we as artists use to serve our need for self-expression. So yes, an engaging, optimistic melody sometimes is the best thing and the best breeding ground for a song that has depth and has emotion and has difficulty in it, because the superficial sort of or artificial aspects of music, the stylistic conventions, the technical stuff, the craftsmanship that goes into those are simply a different type of hook just to grab the listener. And all we're trying to do is, you know, and of course this is all done at a subconscious level, but all we're trying to do is capture your attention long enough that the real important thing that we're doing, which isn't necessarily beautiful, which isn't necessarily sublime and mellow and or fun or dance worthy, we use all of that stuff so that we can inject our deeper meaning into that, and then the listener can have this juxtaposition between, you know, the sweet and the sour, to vastly oversimplify what we're doing, or what everybody's doing, in order that the experience is unique. You know, like if the goal was just to write pop songs, then throw this whole conversation out the window. It doesn't matter. Then it's just about creating like a fun experience for you to dance to. You know, like Will Smith songs of that era. Every summer something would come out and it was just the song of the summer. Hey Ya, whatever. You know, there was a great history of like fun summer songs that have nothing to do with the way that I make music. You know, And I struggle with that or I was at odds with that for many years as a younger musician and artist, and that I thought that the idea of creating songs just for fun was like against what I was doing, when in fact it's just a parallel line. It sounds similar because there's guitars or there's vocals or there's a rhythm, but ultimately we're not, you know, a pop artist and myself are not doing the same thing.
Right. You can coexist and it's fine.
We coexist and it's great. And I just have, you know, I think it, for me, it was just like growing old enough to realize that, oh yeah, there's some value to that music that I really was like against in the 90s. But there's some value there. It's just not the same type of nutrients and vitamins and minerals that the, you know, the stuff I used to sustain myself on was.
And we'll be right back right after this. Welcome back. It's Kyle Meredith with John Baisley of Baroness. No, that, I mean, and I talk about my favorite artists. In fact, I mean, you know, I like to surround them, because even just a few of these over my shoulder with Depeche and Prince. Yes. And REM, Like, that's what I loved about him, because, you know, and I relate this, like your song on this album, Last Word, I feel like is a really good example of what's going on here, because here's a potentially great sing-along, and then there's so much more under the surface that all of these artists gave right here, you know, and it ends up, you know, being an entry point for me on the record just because of that. It sort of opens the door for everything else.
Yeah, and I think that's, you know, I think that's, it's interesting that you recognize that. You know, I will say, and I think, you know, I think this is a bit of a lost art form at the moment. It's not gone and we're not uniquely interested in it, but I really have always thought that we create records when there's the fact that there are track IDs in between, you know, that create the songs shouldn't lead our listeners to think that that's and there's a bite-sized version of the record, and that being, you know, like any one song. The songs are part of a greater narrative that extends, you know, that extends across the length of the record. Sure, you know, no surprise there. But then I think even the records themselves are sort of microcosmic moments of a story that's even longer than that. And that's if you're the type of artist who just sees that through line from your very first work to, you know, wherever you're going in the future. And I think, you know, I look at artists like Nick Cave or PJ Harvey or you know, Radiohead, you know, maybe Depeche Mode a bit, but like bands who don't, like, the idea of your band is broad enough that you can, there can be stylistic shifts and there can be dynamic peaks and valleys, but it doesn't, that's not like, oh, this was the loud record of theirs, or oh, this was the quiet record of theirs. Like a Nick Cave record is always, even when it's a birthday party, sort of an intrinsically Nick Cave record. It's part of his story. He's telling a tale that only gains that third dimension when you listen to multiple records. You know, when you see the development, you're aware of that sort of thing. And I think it's an important aspect of, you know, of a lot of artists that you don't try to focus your attention to like 3.5 minute servings, because that's, now we're talking about commercial music again. Now we're talking about pop music, which is where it's fine. Like if I was a pop musician and I wrote one great 3.5 minute long song, then I can die easy, because that's sort of the goal, is just to create one timeless thing. Whereas I think when you're a band, or when you're an artist who considers things more in the band way, which is that there's a team, it's like a teamwork effort to create something that should be greater than the sum of its parts, then I think you're holding yourself to, you're sort of playing by slightly adjusted rules. And then it's about maintaining credibility. It's about developing your sound. It's about becoming more authentic and honest. I hate saying authentic or honest when talking about music, but to concern yourself with elements like authenticity and honesty in music, and to be predisposed towards focusing all of your energy on the creative integrity of what you make. Insofar as sometimes I think we even write, record and release songs that aren't very good because they're part of, because they're the 5 minutes of them existing is a necessary counterweight to something else. And without this one piece, which I find fault with, you know, which an audience member might find fault with, or I might not think is the greatest song, but it is there as, you know, it's the dark to balance out some other light, you know. And so I think, you know, we try to let ourselves be in that, you know, to sort of harness that spirit whenever possible, so that, you know, success is achieved before the record is released, you know, because, oh, creatively we feel successful. Therefore, the rest of it's just, you know, icing on the cake. But the act of, I don't know, maybe I'm a bit more like a, approach this a bit more from like a standpoint, like a visual artist or, you know, just like a fine artist. But the process of making is it. That's all of it for me. Which is why I always say, you know, we're a live band, because when we're live, we're in the process of taking a space that's you know, empty and silent and filling it with things that we create. And I think the idea of recording can be the same thing, where the most exciting aspect of, if the most exciting aspect of writing and recording a record is physically making it, then that excitement's audible, and that becomes a big part of the process, which, you know, with our music and with, you know, quite a bit of music you've got up there, there's serious themes, so you have to take it seriously, but you have to have fun, and that's, you know, so it's this balance of energies of, you know, being fired up and impassioned about what you do, but also trying to do something that people can understand long enough that you've gotten their attention, then you can inject something unique and something surprising, yeah, into their environment.
Yeah, I'll add to that too. And watching what you all do, specifically even on this record, stripping everything away at certain points, and it's still being so heavy at the same time. Yeah. I mean, the album, surprisingly to me, begins and ends. In the world of Americana, put the broad label on that, and hearing you all sort of do the folk thing, and for it still to be in the Nick Cave sort of way, you know, since you know, that's a great reference right there. Like, he's a master at that. Like, this is going to be something so rustic, you know, and yet, you know, King of the Murder Ballads. And
absolutely. It's just like, we've had this career trajectory that's been really, I think that is maybe the unique thing about us, is that we don't quite fit anywhere, but that has given us the independence and the sort of freedom to operate everywhere all at once, you know, or anywhere that we choose to, and it allows us to take, you know, our musical creative instincts and just follow them to whatever conclusion that they lead us, and we don't ever have to worry about ideas like, will this upset the, you know, will this upset the orthodox rock listener? Will this upset the orthodox alt rock or metal or hardcore listener? You know, that's not important. What I had an idea many years ago. I don't know if it actually worked. I mean, maybe I'm the wrong person to answer this question, but I certainly asked it, and I asked it of the group, that whatever we do, you know, each record we put out is essentially a statement in time, and each statement that we make should support the idea that we're growing, we're changing, we're evolving, we're adapting, but we're never letting go of what, you know, where we came from. Like, it's this idea of roots, which I think is a really funny thing, especially with music journalists who love to, you know, there's this thing where you say, like, oh, it's like a return to roots. Where I'm sort of like, well, wait, but aren't roots like the one thing that is inflexible? Aren't roots the one thing you don't have to return to, because they're always there?
It's lazy journalism half the time, but yes.
Yeah, for sure. I think nine times out of 10, what it means is, veteran band trying to sound like new young band. That's how I interpret it. But because I think like as a band, where you've got multiple members and everybody's operating in concert to create this, you know, to create music, your roots are the thing that needs to be constantly. You actually don't need to do anything. They're there. If they're not there, then they're not your roots, you know. So our roots were had to do with the idea of expanding, the idea that our trajectory or our musical direction wouldn't be a single direction. It wouldn't be, you know, this isn't a highway for us where we're here at the beginning and we're working towards the end. And then it's just like, okay, well, you got your sound and you refine, you do better, you do worse with it, but you're always moving forward, always moving in one direction. I say, fuck that. I say, why can't we be more galactic or universal and just expand from the center? That way we can always, you know, so to speak, and stretching this metaphor, but like, we can always reach behind us and grab from Americana and folk music, which is a huge influence on our songwriting. But we can also do things like incorporate greater, further elements of synthesizers or electronic music, or we can drag out from, you know, and more, you know, the more extreme music zone that you know, that we originally cut our teeth in, we can take some of the energy of the, you know, those like insanely fast rhythms or insanely loud guitars. Again, everything's a tool. Like the only real instrument are the only real instruments in the band are the four of us. It's what, you know, it's how we sort of extend our hands or our, you know, our muscles or vocal cords, whatever, to express ourselves. So, you know, at any given point in time, I want to be able to reach for my acoustic guitar and in order that I can capably express a heavy attitude or a heavy feeling or a heavy opinion. And then further to that, I also would like to have the ability to grab an electric guitar and an incredibly excited song and say something that isn't heavy. You know, it's more that, like, I think there's expectations in music. I think every, you know, we have music is sort of it's sort of like this weird artistic math where you've got real, like, you've got a real set of limitations. There's only so many notes. There's only so many members in the band. There's only so many combinations of things that you can do that are musical. And as soon as, you know, as soon as we free ourselves from, or as soon as we recognize those limitations, then we can kind of free ourselves from the, you know, the bondage that it seems like they could create. And then it's just purely like, well, just express yourself, you know. Maybe the expectation is that in a song that's like, you know, where the volume's cranked up to maximum and there's everything's distorted, maybe the expectation of that would be that the song is going to be something harsh or brutal or in your face. I tend to go, well, the more sort of edge, grit, dirt, you know, harshness, brutality there is in the sonic realm, maybe that's, you know, that is potentially the best petri dish for something that's really beautiful and really sublime and really tender, because there haven't been a whole lot of things said that way. So perhaps we, as a group of people who are looking for uniqueness and individuality, maybe by subverting expectations, we can get ourselves one step closer to being unique and being authentic and being genuine. Because, you know, as artists, you know, the trade that we ply is in taking raw emotion and filtering it through our kaleidoscope in a unique way that allows the listener and the musician to gain further understanding about that subject or about, it just creates environments where we can, you know, our hearts and our minds can open up in different ways. Mm-hmm. And I think it only makes perfect sense that the more individualized that transmission becomes, then the more unique its response can be. So it's like, it's partially selfish because I want to surprise myself. I want adventure through the act of creation. And, you know, having done this for so long, it's like thrilling to me that I'm at this stage in our career and we still get really fired up about what we're doing because we don't, I think a large part of it is because we don't hold ourselves to standards and ideals that are technical. You know, we're not craftsmen, we're artists. So we can tell a beautiful story in a simple lo-fi way. And we can tell toilet humor through sophisticated embellishments. You know, like everything's on the table for a musician who operates like that.
And we'll be right back right after this. Welcome back. It's Kyle Meredith with John Baisley of Baroness.
And completely taking it out of context with lyrics. It's interesting that the album sort of opens with one of the lines, "I've lost my way," because that seems like exactly the opposite of what's going on here. Like, you know,
and to that end, I was entirely lost through the process of making this record on, you know, in many ways, personally, in many ways, mentally, in many ways, spiritually and physically, there were things that were quite challenging, but for me, and I will walk the walk here and I'll put my money where my mouth is on this. The music is therapy for me. You know, it is, there is something that's tremendously therapeutic for it. And, you know, since forming this band, there has, as I said, there has been no lack of personal challenges to overcome. So I think, you know, I thank my lucky stars every day that I've got this creative spark. And then I've got this band of musicians and bandmates, friends, who are more family to me than creative confidants. And we get to work through our shit together. And we get, essentially take all the negatives and just through this weird alchemical sort of crucible, like spit out something that is actually positive. It's like the denser the weight of the tragedy, the lighter and more brightly shines the response musically. And I think that's been true throughout history. So, again, I just consider myself lucky to have found this, because I don't know how I would deal with any of these. I don't know how I would find myself if I were lost and had no outlet like this.
Well, you all, the bandmates as ingredients and the recipe that you all make. I mean, it's so interesting. Like I said, I keep referring to a lot of my favorite artists, but that's what you all do is exactly what I hope to get from art and music. And again, setting pop music aside for its own fun thing, sure. Like Choir, that track is the most unsettlingly beautiful epic that I have heard in a long time. Well, it makes me feel weird. At the same time, it's like, it's also gorgeous, you know?
Yeah. Well, like, and that's actually a pretty good example because, okay, so musically, that is an improvisation. That was, we it's part of the trilogy, the track before it, Beneath the Rose, and the track following it, The Dirge, are sort of the beginning and end caps on that. And what we really wanted to do and we did quite frequently on this record was, for every moment where we're organized and coordinated, and where the music has to be orchestrated and there is a wrong or rightness to it, we really tried to shake that aspect of songwriting in a group as much as insofar as we're capable of for a record like this. And so Choir was simply a tempo, a rhythm, and a key, and no one knew anything. We just didn't talk about what that song was going to be. It was really purely an idea that we continue the sort of rhythmic ostinato from the song before and just see what happens, because that's something we do quite frequently when we're playing live, which we, especially when we're doing long sets, we'll finish a song and, Nick and Sebastian, our rhythm section, they'll just sort of have a little fun. They'll try out like a funk jam, or like they'll try to just sort of ride one simple cool idea until just to give the audience a break, give the band a break, give us all a little wind down after intense music. And so what we want to do on this record was just include that, but it's difficult to include improvised material on a coordinated record that has to be sequenced, has to be mixed, has to be mastered, has to go through this whole long process, and ultimately goes out to the fans. But it's not a live recording, and I'm not interested in the integrity of a live recording. What I was interested in is the integrity of an improvisation. So we had the idea that here's the beat. Nick, our bass player, like, it's this key. So he's like, all right, just do the one note. And Gina and I had no formal discussion about. None of us had any formal discussion whatsoever in any way, shape, or form about what the song was, where it was going, or how to get there. It was simply a matter of exercising our chemistry, closing our eyes, like sort of just opening up all of your, musical senses and having a conversation with your friends at a very sophisticated level where there's questions posed and responses generated. There's multiple people working at multiple times on creating gentle, subtle dynamics, like a lot of sophisticated things that are hard to even articulate. But because we had no roadmap, we knew that every time we recorded it, we would get something new. And further to that, we understood that the more times we recorded, the more we were going to square it up. So I think that track, we played three improvisations. And the first one was by far the best because no one is playing with the theory of the song in mind. it's all just like little, you know, expressions. I kind of think of it like you know, like a Monet, like one of the garden paintings, or perhaps one of those paintings that he would do cathedrals. It's not, there is a form there. You know, we at the end of the day, we step back and we look at it and go, okay, well, that's, I get this feeling, or I get this sense, and I can see something, but it's not about like the four walls, or the, you know, or the particular, the flowers or the water, whatever. And it's just a lot of moments of energy expressed in such a way that they begin to create a form. And we had to sort of like allow our receptors to operate in that instinctual way for quite a few songs on this record, but that one most definitely. And then when we had this insane instrumental, I had reams and reams of stanzas written, and you know, in this that ended up, some of which ended up being in the song. And I think one night I was worked up about something, having a tough time, or just been arguing with somebody or other, and I really didn't know how to apply a vocal reality to that song. And I just remember going down into my basement studio, and I was just sort of pissed, and all I need to do is get something out of my system. And so I just like chose that poem, and I just kind of read it over the music and tried to stay out of the way of the music itself. And there you have it. You know, there wasn't a lot of labor figuring out how to make it work. There was a lot of labor spent making sure that the attitude with which we all approached our role in that song was the same, was similar, like that it was a matter of feeling space and feeling where the music was taking us, and then trying to get there at the same time as everybody else. And so you get these kind of tensions and it's just sort of like weird dynamic builds, and there's something unsettling about it, because it was completely unsettled. I mean that's, I think that actually worked. Yeah, that turn of phrase actually kind of works here, because we had never discussed or settled on anything, so why wouldn't it feel unsettling, you know? But long answer there, being able to pursue those avenues is something that we as a group had to earn the right to do. You know, it's not something we could have done. It's not something I could have hired three studio musicians to do. It's something that the four of us, because we're a band, because we're a unit, we understand that occasionally our roles are insignificant in such a way that if we realize that insignificance, then we can support the idea of the song a little bit better. It's yeah, it's kind of highfalutin stuff, but it's fun to do.
Yeah, like Lee Ranaldo stuff with Sonic Youth. Like that's, you know, that's sort of where
Sonic Youth was the first, it was the first show I ever saw when I was a kid. I saw Sonic Youth, wow. Superchunk, Boredoms, on Browns Island in Richmond, Virginia. Second show I saw was Nirvana, Half Japanese, and Beat Happening or something like that.
Great lineup.
So. I was really young, but fortunately for me, and I really like thanks to Nirvana and Sonic Youth for bringing those type of bills out on the road for 11, 12 year old kids like me who lived in deep in the country. Like, not only did I not know how insanely interesting what I was seeing was, but I didn't know that there was something different. I didn't know that I was seeing something special. I just thought, well, this is the way you see Lee Ranaldo and Thurston Moore and Kim Gordon pull 30 guitars a piece out on the stage so they can play a set. And every song is like a different guitar. Every song's got, it's like completely strange. Like there's no way you've rehearsed that part before. You know, everything feels like it's equally about to fall apart and also transcendent, sublime beauty in that chaos. And that is something where stylistically we don't sound a thing like Sonic Youth. The spirit of that was something that taught me how to play music. You know, that was my first experience seeing. And I think we played when I was 11, I was or 12 or something, when I was graduating from middle school. It was like one of the first shows that I ever played in front of people. We just did Sonic Youth and Nirvana covers. I mean, it was kind of amazing. And so, you know, so I've always had that idea that like, look, the instruments should come into focus and go out of focus. And it's up, and you don't have to apply any rationale. Just when you feel like, when it feels like exploding, let it explode. When it feels like tightening up and becoming a narrative instrument, then let it be that. But, you know, the thing I think that a lot of people, you know, tangential to the band over the years haven't understood is that where our music is kind of complex. I mean, it is certainly not the simplest thing to play. More importantly than that, it's like playing music is difficult for me. It's not easy. It's not like a thing that just, the technical aspects of music just don't come easily to me. Music, the melody comes easy, you know, harmony becomes instinctual, but like, as far as playing it, if it's not going to be easy, if I'm not like a you know, prodigy of fluidity and dynamics and technique, then I should relish the difficulty and the edge that I've got, because if I didn't have that, I would be able to, that would be another thing that would be inimitable for the prodigies and the fluid musicians. The difficulty is finding grit, is finding attitude, is finding character, because you've, you know, sort of bred your technique out of it or something, or simply put, everybody's expression falls on somewhere on the scale between complete, full, true art, which is like impossible and very, very jagged and very, very difficult to digest, and then pop music, which is like saccharine sweet. And somewhere in the midst of that is how we all choose to play our thing. And I just, you know, I don't have a choice. Mine's going to be a little rough. So we try to play like really complicated music I don't know if it's like to hide that fact or to highlight that fact, but I think sometimes when we're making records that I enjoy writing so far beyond my technical capacity as a performer that it's just that fact where, like, if you're always shooting well beyond your capabilities, then at least you're probably going to land one, you know, millimeter beyond what you've been capable of in the past. And I think I'm just describing like many different types of mindsets to create, but you know, the records come from those subconscious things that, you know, I talk about them in the press, and we talk about them before we do any music. When we get into play, it's just, and I hope we, you know, I hope our instincts are good, and I hope our chemistry is good. I hope that we have a good back and forth. I think with Stone, we really wanted to create, you know, like a bit of a mission statement for where we are now. I think we should always, you know, maybe we should always do that. Every record we put out should be a mission statement for where we are now. That might seem self-evident, but the alternative is to try to improve on some model that you've set up in the past. And I think that can, for a band like us, can be very faulty thinking, because it's just, hey, can we improve something that we've already done well? I think maybe yes, but I think it's more important to understand what we've done well and then to ignore it so that we can focus on something that we want to be able to do well through our music.
Where you all landed on Stone is perfectly what I wanted to hear right now. So yeah, for everything that's going on in your...
We did too.
Yeah, for everything that's going on in your lives, it landed so well as a listener, you know, and I think that's one of the great marriages, right? I mean, I would think that's how you hope. It's like you can do one thing, but for it to go out there in the world and become someone else's, like, it's a powerful record. It's a beautiful record. And I let it wash over me when I needed to, and I dig in when I needed to, and that's all I could ask for.
Yeah, because I think the best records in my life that I haven't been part of, the great records for me, are the records that maybe I just like it the first time I hear it. Maybe I don't even like it. It doesn't really, the first listen's like completely immaterial to me. It's just to begin to gain familiarity with the record. But I enjoy if the record's got the quality such that I can get to my 20th listen. I enjoy that 20th listen because that's where I start to hear not the obvious stuff that you know, not just the chords and the textures and the legitimate melodies, but the breathing, you know, the air, the attitude, the swagger, all that stuff, which I think is much more important about music. You know, like once you've got a good hook, then it's then it's your duty as a musician to make it an interesting song, you know? Because writing a good hook's not, I'm not saying that that's easy. I'm saying once you've been fortunate enough to have been blessed with a good hook, or any hook at all, even a bad one, then it's your job to take that hook and do something cool with it, you know? Because if you do what we've already heard with it, no one cares. I mean, I don't think it's got staying power. I think that, you know, one thing that I still love doing, and I think the modern musical climate's made this more difficult by the day, but it's like we all really want to find a record that we've never heard before that's just going to be completely challenging and blow us away. You know, you want to find the early material by some band that everybody's heard of, but you want to find that one song that's just the most amazing thing they've ever written that no one's ever heard. You want to have that secret forbidden knowledge. I think that that's a difficult thing to achieve these days, but what one thing that we set out for, and we just hope that we can get there, is to create a compelling listen that can be listened to in that sort of superficial, like doing household chores or whatever, and it's on, and there's something there that's fun for that, but then for the dedicated headphone listener, that there's some meat on that bone as well. And then, you know, that it feels good when you're driving your car or walking out on the street, that there's a blanket of atmosphere that takes you out of reality just for a little bit, you know, and that's part of music.
Well, John, thank you for giving a damn all these years. I really mean that. Thank you for giving a damn and doing what you guys
do. Of course.
Congratulations on this record. And I appreciate you taking the time to talk all about this. It's been one of my more fun conversations I'll have probably all week. So.
Awesome. Yeah. Well, I love talking about music. I would talk about somebody else's music, but unfortunately I'm here to promote our records.
Yeah, we'll do that next time. Yeah. All right, man. I really do appreciate it. Thank you so much. Take care, and I'll see you around.
Yes, indeed.
My thanks to John. The new Baroness album is called Stone. Thanks to you for checking out the episode. Again, please do hit that subscribe button so you can keep up with all the interviews that we put out every single week. New ones every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday at Spotify, Apple Podcast, at NPR, WFPK.org, YouTube for the video versions, or anywhere you get your podcast from, you can subscribe to Kyle Meredith With. And then after that, head over to WFPK.org. So I do a show Monday through Friday starting at 6 p.m. Eastern. You get 4 hours of classic tracks, the best in new music. There's anniversary spins, bonus interviews, music news. One of my most recent shows had the music of Can, Depeche Mode, Black Rebel Motorcycle Club, Cracker, Lauryn Hill, Elliot Smith, Remy Zero, Jonathan Richman, Juliana Hatfield, Pearl Jam, Warren Zevon, Hearts, Tracy Chapman, and my interview with Keanu Reeves and his band Dogstar. That's just an example of what you get every weeknight at 6 p.m. at WFPK.org. Consequence, as your music and film news, you can also find me on any of the old social media spots. The address is always at Kyle Meredith. So I do hope you like and follow along. And that does it for another edition. I'm Kyle Meredith, and I'll see you next time.
All you homeowners have unique needs. Some feel the need to paint their door a vibrant shade of blue. Others have the need to decorate their bathroom with fish, anchors, and other nautical items. And because each homeowner has unique needs, Geico helps you get the right coverage for your home and what's in it. That way, you get exactly what's right for you, even if your needs are unique. Get more with Geico.
Consequence Podcast Network.
It's kind of like this concept that you're driving towards when you're on tour, and you're only in it for like a minute. It seems fleeting. You know what I mean?
It's easy to hear your favorite artist on WFPK from wherever you are. Listen on your smart speaker, live stream from our website at WFPK.org from Louisville Public Media.